What are you laughing at, Steve? Yeah, I did look a bit younger back then. A bit skinnier too, you reckon? Now, how many of you here have said, I do before? Like, I mean, I do in a marriage ceremony, yeah? Yeah? Well, I reckon that's probably less than half of us here. What do you reckon? That means that a fair number of you are in the before I say I do stage of your life. Great. Now, one of the things that God has created human beings for is for members of the opposite sex to pair up and to start a new family unit with the expectation of companionship and children. But there are a few things that are important to consider from a Christian perspective before you sign your life away and say, I do. So today we'll be considering three aspects. Do I need to say I do? To whom should I say I do? And how to find the right person to say it to? Okay, so that's what we want to deal with today. But let's have a look at the first question. Do I need to say I do? Well, the straight answer is yes. That is, unless you have the gift of celibacy. Now, the Apostle Paul teaches this in our passage, which was just read out for us in 1 Corinthians 7. Important part of a person growing up should be to work out what their gift is in this area. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 7, verses 8 and 9, to the unmarried and the widows, I say that it is good for them to remain single as I am. But if they cannot control themselves, let them marry. For it's better to marry than to burn up. Now, according to what Paul has to say there, staying single actually has some advantages to it. His basic position is that as a Christian, the default situation is the one in which you currently find yourself. For example, in verses 17 through to 24, he says that physically circumcised male believers should be happy in their circumcised state. But if you happen to be uncircumcised, well, that's okay too. Likewise, if you're a slave, if you get the chance to become a free person, then avail yourself of the opportunity. But even as a slave, you can still be content in knowing God and serving Him. So here we see that as Christians, we shouldn't think that we need to change our lives in radical ways in order to be fulfilled. If we have God, we should be fulfilled already. We don't need to think that we need to change our nationality or where we live, our occupation, or even our marital status. More important than our external circumstances is the internal reality of knowing God and being able to serve Him now in our current situation. So don't think the answer to a fulfilled life lies in the quality of your external circumstances. If that's how you think, then chances are you'll never ever be satisfied. So that's why the default position, according to Paul, is simply to serve God in the position in which you currently find yourself. As a Christian, we really should be happy enough in our current circumstances. But obviously, like with the situation of the slave that Paul talks about, if something better comes up, then feel free to take it. To be able to move into better accommodation or to take the job promotion, there's nothing wrong with making use of the opportunities that God might give you, but don't think your life depends on social advancement. So, applying all of this to singleness, as Paul says in verse 27, are you free from a wife? Well, don't seek one. You don't necessarily have to seek one, right? If you're the kind of person who isn't happy as a single Christian, well, what's marriage going to do for you? It might not necessarily solve your problem with a lack of contentment. In fact, as Paul notes in verses 28 and 32, getting married, although a valid option, actually leads to more distress and worry. The external circumstances of a married person tend to be a lot more complicated than those of a single person. As a single person, who do you have to look after? Well, basically, in the end, it's just yourself that you have to worry about. But as a married person, it's a little bit more complicated, right? Who do you have to worry about? Well, you've got to worry about yourself, but on top of all of that, you've got your spouse to worry about, you've got any children that perhaps might be born. All of those things add to the burden of concern that you have as a married person. So, the default position for any Christian who is single is basically work out being content in your current situation. But at the same time, you've got to be realistic. So, those of you who are single, and it looks like it's the majority of us here today, you need to ask yourself this question. Do I need to say, I do? Looking realistically at the increase in trouble and worry that comes with married life, do I really need to get married? You actually need to ask yourself that question. But in asking yourself that question, you also need to look at yourself realistically and specifically to consider what gift it is that God has given you. It's good to stay single if you can, but if you haven't actually been given the gift of celibacy, it's actually best for you to get married. And the question is at this point, how do I know if I've been given the gift of celibacy? Well, I think verse 9 gives us the answer. If you are having trouble controlling your sexual drive, then basically, friends, you don't have the gift of celibacy. Basically, I think you can take it that if you find yourself thinking or dreaming or even at times lusting about members of the opposite sex, then you've got to be honest with yourself. You've been gifted with an active sexuality and you don't have the gift of celibacy. Therefore, you need to get married. You need to find a member of the opposite sex with whom you can say, I do. This leads us to the second aspect of our topic today. To whom should I say, I do? Whom should you marry? I reckon this is a great question, this one. A lot of people are worried about this throughout history of the human race. Oh, who should I marry? Who's the one for me? A lot of people have wrestled with this question. But as Christians, the thing we have, which is to our benefit, if we make use of it, is that God has given us clear principles which can help us to work out whom we should marry. Basically, what I'm going to suggest to you is that we can use biblical principles to eliminate people from the set of the world population out there and work out, okay, out of everyone who lives in the world, what narrow set of people are actually legitimate in terms of I can marry them from God's perspective. Okay, so let's have a look at these principles. The first one is very clear in the Bible, but it's sadly ignored in many parts of the world today. Anyone of the same sex is out of the equation. This eliminates around 50% of people from the set of potential marriage partners straight away. Okay? Now, the fervent cries in some circles today to legitimise same-sex marriage is not only biologically suicidal from the perspective of human reproduction, but it clearly goes against what the human body has been designed for as created by God. Not to mention how it transgresses God's moral standards as revealed in his word. So that eliminates a big swathe of people from the world population, doesn't it? 50% wiped out straight away. What about the second principle? Well, the second principle is anyone of the opposite sex who is currently married, whether officially or de facto, or who has been divorced for illegitimate reasons, these people are also out of the equation. From a biblical perspective, these people are already or still in a one flesh relationship with someone else. And we cannot form a legitimate new one flesh relationship with anyone from that group of people. Right? So people who are already taken, they're obviously eliminated from the equation. Thirdly, what's the third principle? Well, anyone who is closely related to us, also out of the equation. Now, according to Leviticus 18, this includes parents, grandchildren, full siblings, half siblings, daughters-in-laws, aunties, etc. It's pretty straightforward, that one. What about the fourth principle? Well, this is the principle that anyone who has not yet reached puberty, they're also eliminated from the equation. Now, according to Ezekiel 16, a girl reaches the age of love when the signs of full adornment and physical maturity are present. And we assume the same thing applies to boys as well. Now, I should note at this point that even though the Bible doesn't set an age on when a person can get married, it only indicates puberty as the appropriate minimum, Australian law is actually a lot tougher here than God's law, it seems, because Australian law specifies 18 as the normal minimum age for marriage, or 16 in exceptional circumstances. The fifth principle is non-Christians. Non-Christians are also out of the equation. It's getting narrower here, isn't it? In 1 Corinthians 7:39, Paul, when talking about widows who remarry, says that widows are free to remarry, but only in the Lord. In other words, they're only to marry a fellow Christian. And this principle applies across the board to all Christians, not just to widows. Now, what does this mean in theory? Well, in theory, it means that Christians should only marry other Christians, which biblically means anyone who's been baptized as a Christian or who's a descendant of a Christian person, if you understand it in terms of covenant relationship with God. This also eliminates a fair number of people from the marriage equation, right? Those who are not in a special relationship with God. Now, having applied those five biblical principles, there are two more that aren't specifically mandated in Scripture, but which can be considered to be implied in the teaching of Scripture. In particular, the idea of husband and wife as one flesh, that idea has particular important implications. So, principle number six is you can't get married to someone you don't know, right? Or to someone you'll never ever meet. This eliminates all the potential marriage partners who have died or who haven't yet been born. Is it possible to become one flesh with a dead person? I don't think so, realistically. Principle seven. Well, this follows on from this, and this is where we get to the set of people which it's legitimate for us, if we're single and available, to marry. Okay, out of the set of available and potential marriage partners remaining, after we've eliminated all of those categories, when it comes to you choosing who you're going to marry, the idea is, on the basis of the one flesh principle, choose anyone within that set with whom you can see yourself as being able to enter into a one flesh relationship. Now, what do I mean by a one flesh relationship? Well, it's picking up the language that was used of Adam and Eve. But a one flesh relationship indicates an intimate, physical, and spiritual relationship. Okay, one flesh just doesn't mean physical closeness, it also implies spiritual or psychological unity as well. Marriage, biblically speaking, is meant to be a relationship between a man and a woman that is so close, it's like you become one person, one flesh. A one flesh relationship in marriage is more than just physical intimacy. It involves you becoming one with your spouse in how you view the world together. Now, if marriage is about beginning and developing a relationship like that, then this means that you need to find someone within the set of potential marriage partners with whom you can commit to developing that kind of relationship. And this is where physical attraction and spiritual and psychological attraction can play an important role. Now, I don't think that a person necessarily needs to be physically attracted to their spouse, right? Doesn't necessarily have to be that way. But the more attraction that exists, well, hopefully the easier it will be to be able to enjoy physical intimacy with your marriage partner on a regular basis and work at that one flesh relationship. But more important than physical attractiveness is actually spiritual attractiveness. A man should be asking himself, is this the woman that I would be willing to sacrifice myself for in everything I do in order to make her more godly? And a woman should be asking herself, is this the kind of godly man that I can respect and follow and do everything that I can to help achieve the work that God has given him to achieve? So don't really worry about, okay, is this Mr. Right or Mrs. Wrong? Instead, what we need to do is to think very seriously about whether the person in front of you that you're thinking about in regards to marriage, is this the kind of person that you can commit yourself to in order to become one flesh and one soul with that person? It's an important thing to think about. Now, the third aspect that we want to consider today is how to find the right person to say I do to. We could call this examining the options or exploring the field. Now, in the culture of the world around us, this is talked about in terms of boyfriends and girlfriends, dating or hooking up and falling in love, and even sadly, falling out of love. Now, friends, none of those concepts are ever mentioned in the Bible. And honestly, I don't think that they're helpful concepts for us as Christians. God hasn't created you to fall in and out of love or to play the field. He's created you not just with a heart, but also with a head. And he wants us to use both when it comes to intimate relationships. Our job as Christians is not to play the dating game the way that the world does. If God has given you the gift of an active sexuality, then he wants you, as you grow up and mature, to use the biblical principles that we've talked about today to make a rational decision about who you'd like to approach to be your lifelong partner in marriage. So, from a Christian perspective, if you have the gift of an active sexuality and you aren't yet married, you really shouldn't be looking out for a boyfriend or girlfriend. If you're a man, you need to be looking for a wife. And if you're a woman, you need to be looking out for a husband. Now, in order to do that, if possible, it's a great idea to get to know some of the potential marriage partners that fit the bill in terms of the principles that we've talked about today. Now, in order to get to know another person, that obviously requires talking to suitable members of the opposite sex and getting to know how they think about marriage. But make sure you lead with your head and not your heart. Now, I'm not saying here that there isn't any place for romance, but sounding out a member of the opposite sex on the shared assumption that you are both looking for a partner in marriage is a lot better than wasting time and shedding tears over unrequited love that is directed by worldly desire more than Christian principles. It's a lot better to be open and honest in what you're seeking and then to see how the other person responds, and how far the discussion can go. Now, a bit more practically here, when exploring whether a particular person might be a suitable partner, it's good to have particular questions in mind, to ask each other to see whether or not developing an intimate physical and spiritual union with that person is attainable. And you might be wondering, what kind of questions might be appropriate to ask a potential spouse to sort of sound these things out? Well, I'll let you know. Probably get in trouble for this, but I just happened to, in my possession, a letter. A letter, precious letter, dated the 12th of June, 1996. It's the front page up there, right? It also has the time specified, 11:30 a.m. Being quite specific here. It was actually written to me by the woman who became my wife, in which she gives her answers to 12 questions. 12 questions which were obviously put by me. Now, I guess you could say, well, I'm not sure. Is this a love letter? I don't know. But it's sort of at least heading in that direction, don't you think? It's heading in that direction. And I'm sure you all really want to know the content of this letter, right? Want to know the content of this letter? Well, I won't give you a full translation. It is actually in Vietnamese. But I'll give you the gist of the questions that I actually asked. Plus, it finishes off with three questions asked of me. Okay, so you ask questions, the other person has the right to ask questions of you as well. A few examples, yeah? Keen to know? All right. Why are you a believer in Jesus? Why do you believe in God? What do you understand is God's will for you? What's the role? I'm building up to it. I'm building up to it here because the next question is, what's the role of a husband and the role of a wife? It's sort of heading in that direction, don't you think? Next one. How should a husband and wife deal with disagreements? How many children do you want? That's pretty romantic. But I tell you, the answer was two. Anyway, five. I don't think she's complaining. Also, what do you think about family planning? Well, with five, obviously that didn't work. Or perhaps I should say that's what happens when you pretty much just let nature take its course. Now, how should children be disciplined and educated? What's your attitude to money? What's your attitude to living simply? Where would you like to be married? Because this was happening overseas. And what difficulties would you face if you were to live in another country? Okay. So there's some questions might come in handy for you. And I was asked the following. Do you still want to marry me? Great question, that one. I sort of think, hang on. Just give me time to process the content of this letter first, please. And the next one was, if after we are married, I can't stand living far away from you, how will you organise things to be able to both finish your studies and be here with me? Oh, poor little thing. She was worried that me finishing off my final year at uni back in Australia would mean us being apart for a while. Anyway, I'll just leave it at that. But it gives you a bit of a flavour for a sample of the kinds of questions that may come in handy next time you are asking whoever it may be that might possibly be your perfect match. Well, friends, if God has given you the gift of an active sexuality, basically, you need to get married. And in going out to find the person that you're going to marry, basically the message of today is, please keep in mind the biblical principles that we've talked about. In working out who you should talk to and how you should treat them, including the kinds of questions that you might ask. Marriage is a big decision, and we need to prepare for it following the principles of God's word.